Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Russ Newcomer, and we are going to be discussing A Fire Upon the Deep by Werner Vinge, which was the co-winner of the 1993 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Russ, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Seth.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I was going to ask you before we started recording how long ago it was that you put your name in the hat.
I think it was March, February or March.
Okay, so that's not that bad.
No, it's not that bad.
It looks like it was February. I just looked.
Yeah, I was trying not to be overeager and use a quote like, "Why should you let me on here? I'm like Zaphod Beeblebrox. I'm just this guy, you know." But
right, exactly. Well, why don't you tell folks about yourself?
Yeah, so my nerdy history is really, I've been a nerd as long as I can remember. Always liked computers, sci-fi. When I was 6 years old in the early 90s, six or seven, I saved up $60 so that I could buy the Star Trek 25th anniversary Interplay adventure game. And let me tell you, as a seven-year-old in the mid-90s, that took me quite a while. And then I had to save up another $15 to get the hint guide because I wasn't really able to solve any of the adventure puzzles. So just really been into sci-fi reading. My family has, when I was growing up, my dad built my mom a library in our basement that when we last calculated, it contains about 20,000 books. So just read a lot when I was a kid. A lot of sci-fi and history kind of stuff. Then when I got into college, I didn't really enjoy school. I liked reading more, and I started reading. I started reading a lot more quality sci-fi instead of just whatever was, you know, randomly at the library or you know, somebody recommended. So I first read this book sometime around 2000, 2002.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm a software developer here in the Midwest. We enjoy our feeling of occasionally missing out from any big cultural trends, and then occasionally glad we're missing out from any big cultural trends. Right.
Pretty much, yeah. I know that you mentioned you've read quite a few of the Hugo winners, and you can talk about the actual number if you want to, but I was curious if you were one of the people who was like, I set out to read them all, and that's how you found the podcast.
No, I don't actually know for sure where I found the podcast. Okay. I might have been looking for a list of Hugo winners. I might have been looking for another sci-fi podcast. After I started listening, I noticed you had a lot of incomparable people on early, so maybe I got linked over from one of them. Not really sure.
Okay. Well, how many have you read? Do you want to talk about that?
So I was going through, and I'm at like 27 and two-thirds, because there's a couple books that I've tried to read multiple times and just bounced off of, not able to finish. So I'm pretty sure I've completed 26 of them.
Okay. I like that term, bounced off of. It's better than like, I didn't like, or, you know, it just, there's some books that that it kind of does happen. And if you have the luxury of not having to record a podcast about it, you know, you can be like, oh, I'll circle back to that another time.
Yeah. You did a episode recently on Stand on Zanzibar, I think. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to read that five or six times and never gotten more than 50 pages and thought, this is just not for me.
Yeah. That is an interesting one to try to get into, because it takes a while for the plot momentum to build. If you're looking at it, you know, if you're reading it for that.
Yeah.
So why did you choose this book?
This is one of my favorite novels. I really enjoy Vinge's world building. As a software developer, I've found that a lot of science fiction, the software and computer systems in it is a lot of hand waving. You know, it's not really realistic. And Vinge's a longtime computer science professor at UCSD. So what he's got in here, you know, there's obviously going to be some hand waving in sci-fi, no matter what. But the computer systems aspect of A Fire Upon the Deep and Vinci's other works really feels realistic, well thought out. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate that. I spent some time overseas in a place where I was really weight limited on what I could take. And so instead of taking books, I took a Kindle and I tried to minimize the amount of entertainment reading I had. And so I had like 5 novels and this was one of them. So I read it a lot of times in the couple years that I was overseas.
Nice. And have you read the rest of the series that this is in?
Yeah, I've read, Vinci is one of my favorite authors. So I've read, I've read basically all his short fiction, novels, pretty much everything that he's put out.
Nice. Yeah, I was re-listening to, I did an episode on A Deepness in the Sky, and on that one, Olav mentioned the batting average for Werner Vinci is pretty remarkable when you think about the number of novels that he actually has out and how many of them have been at least nominated for a Hugo.
Yeah, so. And the third book in this series, Children of the Sky, is generally lesser regarded than the other novel, but it's still... It's still like a, 7 out of 10 novel. It's still a good work. It's just not at the same level as the first two books in the universe.
Yeah, yeah. So why don't we go ahead and move into the kind of formal non-spoiler discussion of the book? Can you give a quick, as non-spoiler as possible, synopsis?
Yeah. So I spent a lot of time trying to come up with a good elevator pitch for this that isn't too spoilery. So this is my attempt. My attempt is, at the edge of the galaxy, humans resurrect an ancient Cthulhu-like AI. One family desperately escapes deep into the safety of the inner galaxy where the AI can't function and pursue them. Stranded on a primitive planet, they must make common cause with factions of an alien race against local enemies. Where will their human and alien rescuers arrive in time?
Nice. Very good. I like it. Yeah. Okay, kind of moving into overall thoughts. You already mentioned that this is one of your favorites. It's a first time read for me. I'm reading this series out of order because I started with A Deepness in the Sky, which honestly, no real impact between the two books here, other than like I recognized the name of Fam Nguyen. And I knew some things about him that his character didn't necessarily know for a lot of the book. But I will say I enjoyed this book. I think I probably like A Deepness in the Sky better, but they're both thumbs up reads for me. The similar thing between A Deepness in the Sky and A Fire Upon the Deep is they're both packed with ideas, and you could pull on those threads and make entire series out of little bits of it. And he packs it all into one book, which is impressive.
Yeah, I made a bunch of notes when I was rereading this for this podcast, and multiple times I noted he just takes an idea and drops it in, and it's, maybe 2 pages of plot. It's a total side, thing. And somebody else would make a, 200 page novel out of that easy. And he just drops it right in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty impressive. This was the co-winner with Doomsday Book by Connie Willis, which I'm a huge fan of. So I'm not going to compare those two books. They're very, very different. So I won't, it will show up in my running ranking that I keep, but I'll keep people in suspense. They can go over and look.
Yeah. I think that's really this is one of the few years that the Hugo's had a co-winner
it's a couple times.
I remember. And I think it's really interesting because those two, I'm actually reading the Doomsday Book right now. And those two they feel very different, but very good. And I'm not surprised that there were co-winners that year.
Yeah. So you haven't listened to the Doomsday Book episode yet?
No. No, I have not.
Okay. I will say it's a winner. So I do want to, do you think it's appropriate to talk about the zones of thought in non-spoilers? I feel like it is.
I think so, because I feel like spoiler talk can be, if you can't talk about like what's in the first chapter or two, and the zones definitely are in those first couple chapters. So yeah, it's a very intriguing idea. To summarize, Vinci's way of solving the Fermi paradox is postulating that there are these zones in the galaxy where in a specific zone, computation can run, I don't know the best way to say it, but run at a certain speed or function at a certain level. So the center of the galaxy, they call it the slow zone, where there's AI can't function. Seems like maybe even human level intelligence can't exist. And then you move, as you move out from the center of the galaxy, the AI and biological intelligence level goes up, up, up until you get out to what Vinji calls the transcend, which is where the Cthulhu-like AI that I reference in the elevator pitch is out in the transcend.
It's interesting you mentioned Cthulhu there, because the age of some of these AIs, or I guess they call them powers, right, in the book, really does kind of lend itself to that kind of mythos. I thought the lowest level was, they called it the unthinking depths or something, like even further down than the slowness. Because in the slowness, that's where Earth is, right?
Right. And that's where they flee to is right at the edge of the slow zone.
Right. And so it's a fascinating idea. It's from a theological perspective, or even just a thinking about the nature of the universe. What does this organization of the universe tell you about it? And to me, it says there has to be some kind of power out there who's controlling this, who's doing something with it. And the book does go into some of that about the shifting of the zones. Or I feel like if I was in this universe, I'd be like, okay, it's a simulation and we have to figure out how to game the simulation in some way. But I think that's kind of my default for any time the universe is weird in a book. I'm like, oh, it's a simulated universe.
Yeah.
It's kind of my go-to.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that I really thought was interesting about this is, like I said, Vinji, some of the notes that I've read or interviews that he's done, he came up with the idea of zones of thought because as a computer science professor, he's like, I think computers are going to get fast enough that we're going to have general AI and, you know, von Neumann self-replication, but we're not seeing that. Why would, like, what's an answer for why we wouldn't be seeing that? And so he comes up with the idea in like the late 70s or early 80s. And his then wife wrote a novel series that I think doesn't explicitly mention zones of thought, but has that as part of the background. So it percolates with him for like 10, 15 years before he ever writes the main novel. And you can really tell because it is a really well thought out universe and thought out concept.
Very much so. Yeah. And the other thing, you mentioned that computation can only take place at certain rates, and that goes for kind of all technology as well, right? Where in the beyond, you have the ultra drive and the ultra wave communications that are superluminal. And so you're not bound by Newtonian and Einsteinian, relativistic physics in the beyond, and especially in the high beyond, right? I kind of took it that people who inhabit the beyond, at some point, you know, they kind of develop into like a singularity kind of situation where they can transfer their consciousness into machines and then somehow they move into the transcend. But I'm not sure if that's what the book is trying to say or it just kind of makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, that idea is in the book, and it's interesting that you mentioned the singularity because Werner Vinge is really the one who coins the term, the singularity. He's got, his 1993 paper and talk really like spring out of what he has thought through from this novel series.
Right, right. So we can talk a little bit about the plot of the book without getting too much into spoilers. I don't know how much we want to do that. I do want to talk about comps to the book, if there's anything that you want to mention that's comparable to it.
Yeah. So I had a couple thoughts. There's really like numerous aspects to this book. And so some of my comps are specific to, certain aspects, but so like the space opera style, some of the things that I feel are comparable, David Brin with the Star Tide Rising and Uplift War has some of the galactic spanning, cultural questions feel.
Yeah.
Anne Leckie's ancillary series, I feel like has a lot of similarities in this book ends up with a lot of questions on identity and mm-hmm. questions of personhood that I yeah. feel like that ancillary series really covers. And then Charles Stross, he has a book, Singularity Sky, that he kind of doesn't like because he wrote himself into a corner, but it also deals with the singularity and some, you know, some implications of what the singularity would be like and how that would affect humanity. So okay. that's another comp. The Zones of Thought idea, Alistair Reynolds has a book called Terminal World that is really one of the only other books that I've ever seen anything like the Zones of Thought in that I think it's a pretty fun book. It's one of his, Reynolds's more controversial. Some people really hate it. Some people really like it. Okay. I talked about earlier how they flee to a planet that's inside just on the border of the slow zone, that we have some adventures then on that planet. And so that kind of high tech people on in a low tech place. There's David Weber has a series called the Safehold series that kind of deals with some of that. He wrote a book series or co-wrote a book series that's the March Upcountry series that has kind of that, you know, super advanced beings on a primitive planet and how they how they navigate that. So those are like different aspects of the book, but those are the comps that I came up with.
Yeah, it's interesting to try and come up with comps for a book that has kind of so many aspects as this one does. I had the Uplift series as well. And I mentioned, I put Ringworld in there as well, just kind of having the mix of aliens working together. The Diamond Age was another one that I put in there just because on the Tynes planet, the data set kind of serves a similar function as the Young Ladies Illustrated Primer.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I hadn't thought of that, but that does, that does line up.
Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about in non-spoilers, or do you want to dive into spoiler time?
So, I guess this is better for overall impressions, but, one of my thoughts is this is really in baseball terms, it's a 5-tool book. Vinji, like his prose is not, you know, it's not William Gibson, but it's good.
Right.
And his world building is, it's not Tolkien or Frank Herbert, but it's really good. His characters might be a little flat, but he uses them very well. I just feel like it's, you know, there's no aspect of this book that really drags it down that you, or for me, that I say, okay, I kind of ignore that part.
Right, right. I think it's a long book. It's not as long as A Deepness in the Sky, but that one I didn't feel like really suffered from the length. I think the length was appropriate. And this one, I feel the same. Like if it had stretched out a little bit more, I would have been like, okay, let's get to the end here. But I felt like this one was pretty well paced actually. And I'm 100% here for any baseball science fiction analogies. So,
all right.
All right. Why don't we go ahead and just dive into spoilers? That way we can talk about whatever we want to talk about. Anything you want to lead off with?
Well, I'm really curious. One of the things that I love about this book is the net of the million lies conceit and how he pulls that off. Which it's Usenet in intergalactic space. But he manages with the with relay and with the transmission, you know, struggles that you would have transmitting across interstellar distances. He pulls it off. But I read this book 20 years ago when you know we were still all either. I mean, I was never really on Usenet, but web forums, early web forums were, you know, a lot of the same. You're reading it new in 2021. How did that strike you?
At first, I thought, okay, this is a 90s author taking the state of the art and figuring that that's what we're going to have in the future. But I don't think that was a fair assessment of it. And on further reflection, I was like, well, but anytime you're talking about those kind of distances, you're going to want to have a fairly simple communication pathway that you can fall back on. I think it's possible to imagine there being, you know, full video chat kind of stuff over interstellar distances with the ultra wave communications. But this makes sense, you know, the kind of Usenet looking transcripts that you get in the book make a lot of sense for just like simple point-to-point communications.
Yeah, I have just always really loved that. I really love how he uses it to introduce characters into the flow of the plot and pacing that you don't actually want to meet. You don't need to know a whole lot about them, but the way that he structures those postings where you can, you know, it's got look like Usenet headers, so you can see where it came from, the translation. I love how he's got the translation pathways and says, you know, this may be not an accurate translation. I just really love that conceit. Mm-hmm.
I kind of was like, where are the mailing list archives kept for this? Are they like searchable later on? Because it's got like, you know, tags in it for things you would want to search.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, and I come from a family where I have numerous members of my family were either librarians or school librarians. So then Ravna's character as a archivist and librarian, that has always also really intrigued me. And the idea of there is so much data that somebody has to sift through it and have the cultural knowledge and background to say, hey, this data, this is valuable, this is not valuable, you know, what Ravna's expertise and really reason for getting to go on the mission and be a part of the of the story is.
Yeah. I was sucked right into the book by the prologue, right, that talks about essentially what is it, Stromly Realm? Is that what it was called?
Like
they sent a delegation into the transcend, into the low transcend, right, to investigate this, what turned out to be, they called it the Stromly perversion or the blight later. It was a really intriguing way to deal with AIs and the fact that there was more than one present there, right, where there's two other apparent AIs who are like, you know, this is not good. We need to help if we can, even though, it, you know, they both those other AIs know they're doomed if they help, but probably if they don't help, they're doomed anyway.
Yeah.
But it's an extremely long con that the Stromly perversion is playing, right? Because we find out, and this is major spoilers, right? We find out later on that it was the Blight that created the Scrode Riders. And that was a, that was really, really fascinating. I didn't see that coming at all.
Yeah, I didn't. I wish I could go back and reread this book, forgetting everything that I know about the plot, and to rediscover, like, how much did I not see that coming? You know, because now on subsequent rereads, you know, you see all the little details that Vinji does put in there and says, okay, this is coming. And I was, that was something that I made notes on, that I'm not sure that the Blight is the actual creator of the writers.
Right.
I think it may just, have corrupted their systems, or have given them the greater, because there's the greater writers and the lesser writers, and I think it may have like given them their scrode that then can function.
Yeah, that was the impression I got. That it didn't necessarily design the species, but found them and added the scrodes to them, and then kind of made them, you know, kind of throughout the galaxy.
But yeah, like you said, the idea that that was 5 billion years ago, and it did it in such secret that, you know, 5 billion years later, everyone has forgotten. You know, no one wiped out the writers back then and let them continue. So two of the big themes that I really had in this book are identity and personhood, and because the identity, like, we see that in the characters that are all the major characters kind of end up questioning their own identity in some way. You know, you have it really pretty directly with the Tynes, because they talk about how I get a new member and it changes me. Mm-hmm. You know, you have it with Johanna and with Jeffrey. You know, they're kids, they're stranded on this alien planet, they're trying to figure out who they are, what, yeah, you know, what they're supposed to do. You have it with Pham, who is this put back together human that's also occupied, right, by this God Shatter. Like, who is he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he wonders that through the book, right? And he's kind of a Frankenstein monster, right? And that, going back to the zones of thought, right, the idea that you can reconstitute a person from their constituent parts, well, you can't do that in the slowness, obviously, except for the example in Frankenstein. But here, this is the old one that put him back together.
Yeah.
And then he has to question, are my memories of my previous life, are they artificial? Are they real? And he doesn't know that until the very end. Which, you know, I knew it just because I had already read A Deepness in the Sky, and so I already knew quite a bit about him.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, and then how that, like, those questions of identity don't get neatly resolved for, yeah, a lot of the characters, but that's what pushes the, like, that's what pushes the character development forward. Because really, when you stop, mm-hmm, and you look at these, a lot of these characters really are, start out pretty flat and pretty, mm-hmm, you know, forgettable if you just read like the first 200 pages. But
yeah,
as he keeps going and keeps, you know, developing this, these questions of, okay, we've got this group mind, we've got this guy whose brain has been put back together, we've got these, you know, this ancient AI, who are all these people and what all are they doing? I find that exploration of identity and personhood in this book really, really fascinating.
Yeah. I will say that the Tynes with their group kind of emergent intelligences, the pack intelligences, those were compelling to me right away. It took me a little bit to kind of catch on to the fact that that's what was going on. And the book is really good at not just coming right out and telling you everything about it, or even really describing them. It describes in the ambush on Starship Hill, when the craft initially lands, you know, that there's more than one person manning a crossbow, for instance.
Yeah. Like,
well, how is that? What's going on exactly with that? Yeah, really, really interesting idea of the emergent property of consciousness in them, and that, you know, a singleton doesn't necessarily have that kind of intelligence, and you have to kind of combine them into supercomputing clusters of intelligence in order for there to be a personality, which is then, of course, changed when you swap out a faulty hard drive.
Yeah, and I just thought the idea of, okay, some of the packs can mesh together to form these giant work mobs that, you know, they, yeah, don't know what they're doing while they're working. And then, like, the idea of the line intelligence that they talk about at one point, that it takes, yeah, minutes for a thought to propagate across the line.
Yeah.
And that goes back to the Vinci just takes these things that in another book would be 200 pages, or you can just imagine somebody writing, mm-hmm, chapters and chapters about this, and he's just like, oh, here's this idea I had, plops it in and moves, right, on.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I think if we didn't have, I don't think the book would work without having that idea in here, right? Because you have to have some alienness. And this is one thing Vinci's good at. The spiders and A Deepness in the Sky were really cool. The Tynes, I think, are just a masterpiece. Just really, really cool. I mean, I'm a dog person, so that didn't hurt.
Yeah, and he does such a good job with the Tynes too of differentiating them while, mm-hmm, still retaining the alienness of,
yeah,
like, you don't forget that Scriber is one of the Tynes, or that a woodcarver is one of the Tynes, but,
right,
you sense the difference between them, like between the characters, and they're still Tynes. It's not like they're just another version of human with a, you know, with bumpy foreheads like in Star Trek. They're still very alien.
I really did enjoy at the beginning of kind of relating how the Tynes worked, where it had a name that was like Rick Rackscar, or it ended up Rick Rackscar, right?
Rick Rackrum, I think, was at
the beginning. And then, you know, as one person is, someone might be killed or something, then you bring somebody else in and you change the name. I was a little confused throughout the book by Amdi Jeffrey, or Amdi Jeffrey, depending on, I listened to the audiobook some, I read it in print some, and they said Amdi Jeffrey. And I was trying to figure out where the Jeffrey part was from. Was that just referring to the, to how close the puppies were to Jeffrey?
Yeah. If you would reread it, you'd notice that it's the Tynes that say Amdi Jeffrey.
Right.
So they don't like it, again, you know, trying to figure out how that culture would work when you've got this person that's a singleton, that's a, you know, is an individual person, but you, the idea of individual person is totally alien to you. So
right.
So it's the other Tynes that say, let's say Amdi Jeffrey.
Okay. So they basically put him into Amdi's pack.
Right. Because they don't, you know, they don't know what else to do with him.
Mm-hmm. It is a little bit convenient that the Tynes are able to basically mimic any sound. And so that they can learn to have, not English, what was the language? Samnorsk?
Yeah.
Or something?
Yeah. And that's, that was another... another comment that I had that I think maybe fits in here is hard science fiction versus soft science fiction is there are people that classify A Fire Upon the Deep as hard sci-fi. And I understand it, but like Ultrawave and Group Minds and all that, like really that's that's pure hand waviness. Where it is hard sci-fi is the computing systems and the the questions of how would these, like, how would this different mental models and different processing abilities and powers, whether it's a group mind or a transcendent AI, how would that actually play out? So, like, I feel like the best hard science fiction writers are aware that they're going to hand wave somewhere, and they really lean into their strengths and letting that strength be what makes it hard sci-fi. And I think Vinge really does that really well. I feel like he's one of the only famous, you know, big names sci-fi authors that really does computing systems really well. Like maybe you could convince me Neal Stephenson with Cryptonomicon and some of his earlier stuff, but you know, most people talking about computing systems, I just feel like it's not really hard sci-fi, but Vinge really does that really well.
Right. Yeah. I feel like it's fair to say that Vinge is rigorous with his, you know, trying to be consistent in all the technologies, and the Zones of Thought lends to that. Like if you look at the level of technology we have now that of course we didn't have in 1992 when he's writing this, or when it was published anyway, we have now, you know, made significant advances in natural language processing, right? When you tell your phone to do something, it rarely gets it wrong anymore. And it used, you know, 10 years ago, it was terrible, voice recognition was. And it's getting better with machine learning algorithms and that kind of stuff. But, you know, you extend that outside of our level of technology into a zone of the universe where computation can be even faster. Well, then all of a sudden, you can very easily on Usenet just translate between different language groups that something comes from, and everybody can read it. And, you know, probably your whatever your terminal is just renders it in whatever works for you. And it tells you, you know, there's some level of possible mistranslation here. But yeah, rigorous is what I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah. I think rigorous is a good way to say that. So a couple of the other things that I notes that I had made in this book, Vinge really likes lost little boys as characters because, you know, Jeffrey is a lost little boy. Amdi is a lost little boy. Really, Scriber is kind of a lost little boy at the start.
Yeah.
Steel really is also this lost little boy. I mean, his father was a terribly abusive, you know, evil mastermind. But you see throughout all this that he really wants to prove himself to Flenser. Like that is
definite daddy issues, big time. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and Fam definitely also lost little boy out in the universe. And so it's interesting to look at how each of those characters evolves in different ways and how Vinji takes that. Okay. These characters are all from this same archetype but I'm going to, you know, spin this one off this way and this one the other way and how they all play together. I thought that characterization really was, really well done.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. With Fam, the fascinating thing with him is, of course, you know, he's not sure where the old one ends and he begins. And so it's an interesting dilemma for him when he realizes that the Scrode Riders have been corrupted in some way, and he's not sure that he can trust them anymore because of that possible reprogramming. It's ironic given that he's clearly someone who's been programmed on some level. And I think he comes to realize that toward the end and kind of regret that before Blue Shell makes his amazing sacrifice at the end, you know, that I wish that I hadn't had that mistrust, that time of mistrust and that time of not being friends when this guy is clearly very noble.
Yeah. And I think really what Vinji takes Fam Nguyen through to, like you said, with the where do I begin? Where does the old one end? I think one of the things that really shows itself in is the scene in, I can't remember, the junk dealer's yard where Greenstock gets corrupted, where Fam really has to make this decision of, like, what do I do next? And you really, Vinji really shows you there. He's got this tough guy exterior, but he's really kind of panicking and I don't know what to do and making these split second decisions. That just, I mean, to me, that goes back to the lost little boy and what you were saying with where he begins. I just think Fam is a great character. Maybe my enjoyment of him in this book is colored by the later book that I really love his character there. But Vinji just does so many interesting things with all these characters.
Yeah. I definitely do want to talk about the end. I had to go back and reread it because somehow I had kind of glossed over how the major expansion of the Slow Zone happened. And I'm not sure, I'm still not sure I totally understand the initial surge that happened. I definitely understand the later one with the God Shatter. But do you know why the initial surge happened that pulled them into the slowness earlier?
It seems like from the text that what's going on is the countermeasure is growing on the ship. And as it is growing, it is basically randomly working. And that those random zone shifts at the start are the countermeasure trying to figure out, can I do something? What's going on? What are my powers? Right. Because, you know, it's really unclear what countermeasure really is. You know, it's described as this smoky mold that then when it merges with Fam has the power to call powers beyond the powers. You know, like we're introduced to this whole other level that Vinji has been, you realize he's never explicitly talked about what might be beyond the transcend or, you know, in the unthinking depths. Cause that's one of the things that I read the ending a couple times when I was preparing for this. Did the 5 billion years ago, did countermeasure create all the zones to protect, the unthinking depths or, was countermeasure created by powers that are outside the transcend? Like the transcend still is affected by whatever is at the galactic core causing the zones. That you know, the blight is trying to expand outside the transcend, but there's not a lot of power available out there because there's no stars, there's no stellar activity, so it's got to go, you know, closer into the galaxy. And so these It's hard to tell where, like, yeah, what countermeasure is. And that's one of the fascinating things that Vinci does, is he sets all this up and then gives you this extra taste, and you don't know where it's coming from. Just like you were asking the ambiguity about how does this first zone surge happen? It's not really clear in the book.
Okay. I think what you said there makes sense with what I got from it. And it was kind of tickling around my brain. I'm like, okay, yeah, I think that's, given what else we know about the really neat idea that as something from the transcend or the high beyond comes down into the slowness, it loses functionality. And if it's not prepared to, as in the Matrix, I can't remember which one of the, I think it was the one with the architect, right? There are levels of existence we're prepared to accept.
Right.
If it's not prepared to do that, then, you know, your ship all of a sudden can just be stuck in the Salonis for all time. And you're just going to, there's going to be a ship full of desiccated corpses that eventually makes it to a planet somewhere. Whereas if you have one that has the, what they call it, the Bussard ramjet, that is like the fastest thing that can work in the slowness, then maybe you're okay. But I think there was even like an instrument that Ravna was using that after they moved into the slowness, all of a sudden it showed less information. And I think that's just a cool idea.
Yeah. And Vinci talks about how, like, you can harden some processors against the slow zone, right, and some stuff will work for a little while in the slow zone. And he sets up too very well the idea that we don't understand what's happening in the transcend. Like, right, we as humans can sort of function in the, you know, in the high beyond, but once you have to make that jump to the transcend, or once you start to make that jump to the transcend and the singularity takes over your planetary system, because that's the level that it seems to interact with, we can't understand what's going on out there, you know. And old one's speech to Ravna of, I thought the blight was just, you know, the trashy neighbor, you know, next door. Right. I didn't realize that it was, I don't know, a militia camp, or, you know, somebody building a nuclear bomb. That there's levels that in Vinci's universe that just can't be explained to, you know, to people that can't get to that level.
Mm-hmm. I just kind of had the idea that, like, things like the, you know, a mummy's curse or something, on, you know, that we talk about in fantasy, literature, or even really in historical legend on Earth, that, you know, you unlock an ancient Egyptian tomb and you let something out. You could see that in the zones of thought, that it could have been, power from the beyond or the transcend that, you know, had a level of interacting that it could do in the slowness. And so when you unlock it, it comes out as this thing that we interpret as some spiritual force or something. I don't know. It's just an idea that I just had.
Yeah. And that's your comment about spiritual force. One of the things that I find very interesting is that Vinci's book is essentially a-religious. Like,
yes.
They talk about, Ravna talks about going to applied theology classes, which are basically thinking about the transcend. But there is, like, on Tyne's world, there is no indication of any kind of religious anything. Which I found very interesting, because a lot of sci-fi includes some religious component, you know, whether it's to say, especially in a book like this that deals with, you know, highly advanced AIs, a lot of books say, okay, these people have, you know, started to worship this AI, or look, we have this religion that's around something that you can't possibly, but Vinci just doesn't have that at all in this book, which I found very, I've always found that part too, very fascinating, that he just cuts that off and doesn't feature it at all.
And the closest thing you have to, like, somebody cursing or something is saying things like, by the fleet.
Yeah.
Which I thought was fascinating.
Two other things that I really wanted to get your feel on as a first time, haven't read this book as much reader. My favorite Usenet character is the Twirlip of the Mists. Do you remember the Twirlip, and what do you think about the Twirlip?
I don't think I remember specifically.
So this is something that I discovered later, but the Twirlip is this like gas bag being from some other, you know, from some distant corner of the galaxy that just spouts off what seem to be random things about the blight and the perversion. But Vinji wrote one of the early Twirlip postings where the Twirlip says, "Hexapedia is the key insight." And you're like, okay, he's just way off. You know, that's way off. But then the writers have six wheels.
Right.
So Vinji has there's a version of this book that is the annotated hypertext edition.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It was distributed on CD-ROM, wasn't it?
Yeah. That has all of his notes. Amazon used to sell it on Kindle, and then at some point they lost the rights, and my great copy, the hypertext annotated copy, got updated to just the regular text, and I was very disappointed. But Vinji notes that he wrote that, and then one of his readers said, "Oh, so are you trying to tell us ahead of time that the Twirlip is the Oracle and telling us everything that happens?" And Vinji says, "No, like that was just a coincidence." But then it seems like he went back and rewrote all of the Twirlip postings to be, you know, essentially crazy man in the sky, but crazy man in the sky that's right. And because of the culture and translation, Ravna reads his postings and just says, "Ah, crazy guy." But if she would have listened to him, you know, 6 months ago, they would have had it all figured out and all planned out.
Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't put that together. I think I had looked at Hexapedia as like one of the Tynes plus one of the humans. But that doesn't even work, right? Because that would be, I mean, that's 12, that's 6 feet. But, you know, they count, of course, our hands as feet because that's the way they think of them.
Well, and at the time of the book where they mention that, they don't know about the Tynes yet.
Right.
So.
Right.
So then the other thing that I thought about in this is Vinji is an academic. Like, he's a computer science professor. If there is a authorial stand-in in this book, it's Ravna, you know, the librarian, I'm going to make my career by being a part of this communication with this kid on this distant planet. So I wonder, did Vinji ultimately write this book for, this is the space adventure that I wish I would have gotten to have when I was in my 20s?
I could definitely see that. I thought it was unexpected to me, the amount that Ravna and Pham and the Scrode Riders were delayed in getting to the Tynes world. I expected, okay, in short term, you know, they're going to make it there. And then it was, we'll be there in, I don't know, 70 days or something. And then it's 90 days. And then it took a long time.
Yeah. This is a like multi-threaded novel, you know, that he's got to eventually pull all the threads together. And the pacing of them getting from Relay to Tynes world, if there is one area that I criticize in this book, it's that pacing, because like you said, it seems like it's going to take them not too long a time, and then it stretches out, and then all of a sudden they're there.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why, you know, for me, the more compelling part of the book was what was going on the Tynes world. And so it was just, what's going to happen here between the two groups? Because you have two factions who are both learning from the humans and manipulating them, and trying to develop technology with their assistance in order to fight the other one off. And it's just a question of what's going to happen, what's the state going to be when the starship finally arrives. And yeah, so I was interested to follow that story. And I just figured, you know, eventually the starship will show up and that'll be the end of the novel.
So you liked the Tynes world more than the Ravna Pham chase part of the story?
Yeah, definitely.
Do you think that was because of the characters or just because it had more to hold your interest?
It's a mixture of both. I really liked, you know, that it's one of my favorite alien species ever, the Tynes, just because of that emergent intelligence and the idea of if there's a fragment of Flenser, you know, a tiny little fragment in a pack, is that eventually going to take over? And there's, what's it, Thylasect? I can't remember what the name of, not Thylasect, I can't remember.
Tyrathect.
Tyrathect, that's it. Where there's a battle going on between different members within the pack over who's going to become predominant in there. And there's even though the battle goes one way, there's influence still, changes in the personality because of that mixture. And I liked all the intrigue with, you had Steel and Vendacious and Woodcarver. I was very interested in all of that.
Yeah.
And finding out, you know, who was whose parent and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I've always thought the Tynes World sequence is most interesting when there is comparison between what's going on with Jeffrey and Amdi, Jeffrey and Steele, and then what Johanna and Pilgrim and Woodcarver are also going through. Vinji really constructs a lot of parallels throughout this novel that, you know, Steele and the Blight are kind of parallel, and Johanna and Jeffrey have similar parallels, and Ravna and Johanna have a lot of, you know, parallels because they have this male figure that they're trying to figure out, do I trust this person or not trust this person? Yeah. And Vinji really parallelizes a lot of the story threads and the character development as he's going.
Yeah. Yeah. I did want to make sure, as we're starting to wind down probably at some point, cause we've talked about quite a bit of it. I did want to talk about the larger series, cause I've read two of them. I've read The Fire Upon the Deep and The Deepness in the Sky. You mentioned Children of the Sky. I also have, I can't remember if it's an ebook or if it's just a slim, mass market paperback of After the Battle on Starship Hill.
After the battle,
a friend of mine gave me.
Yeah, I think After the Battle on Starship Hill is just the first two chapters of Children in the Sky.
Okay, I've heard different, or I've read different perspectives on that. Where some people are like, no, it's not exactly that, and I didn't know if it started life as After the Battle and then kind of morphed into the Children of the Sky or not.
I have always assumed, I'd read several places that it was just the first two chapters of Children of the Sky. So I've never actually read that extra piece.
All right. Maybe I'll, Jason, if you're listening, you should let me know. one of my friends who had recommended the series to me ages ago, he was trying to explain Zones of Thought, and I thought, I can't process that right now.
Yeah. So there's also,
it was interesting though, that the Zones of Thought don't really have any bearing on A Deepness in the Sky. I think it's mentioned, and the one thing that I wondered if it was a connection between the books is the locators, the von Neumann machines, and if that, you know, ended up becoming something that transcended. But I wasn't sure if that's actually a thread that is there.
Yeah, I think that the only real connection between the two is the setting, because the larger setting, and in Deepness, there's questions like, is the Onoff star a transcendent artifact, basically, that is on a, you know, on a loop through the galaxy? They've got the, I think it's like Cavorite, that is basically a grav fabric. The spiders, also, maybe they are a, you know, beyonder or transcendent race, because they sure seem to be engineered to survive in that, you know, in that planet. But, you know, other than that, really, FAM is the, you know, is the connection between the two novels. So there's also, in the late 80s, Vinji wrote a short story called The Blabber, which is, I don't know how to really describe it in that it is a zones of thought story, and there Ravna is in it and there are Tynes, but it is like a alternate. I mean, it's like a Marvel what if, you know, alternate story in the anthology. One of the anthologies that it's in, Vinji says, "I almost wish I hadn't written A Fire Upon the Deep so that I could explore this version of the universe more." It's a fun short story. It's really good. It's in sort of the same setting. It's got some of the same character names, but it's a different animal.
Okay. Interesting. But you said you recommend Children of the Sky, not on the same level as these other two, but still worth reading.
Yeah, I do. I enjoy it. I mean, I've only read it twice, so, you know, it's not in the same pantheon as A Fire or Deepness, but it's good. It is, I think it ultimately, it is the kind of sequel that everyone feared A Deepness in the Sky was going to be, in that it takes the Fire Upon the Deep story and really just kind of picks it up, and it's book two of that series. And without... I know you said like the Tynes world was your favorite part, and so you might enjoy Children of the Sky more. For me, without the larger space opera stuff, it wasn't quite as compelling.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, the way Fire ends kind of negates the possibility of further space opera because of the expansion of the slowness. I mean, you could still tell stories in there, but it'd be more like the story of Famnuin in A Deepness in the Sky, where you're in generation ships, more or less, because you don't have that tech that can get you different places, right? There's the idea that, am I the only person left here on this ultrawave Usenet?
Yeah.
You kind of have there's a note near the end of the book from one of them, right?
Am I
the only one here?
Yeah. Is anybody else here? What's going on? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's something we didn't really talk about, right? The price of defeating the Blight is possibly the destruction of trillions of, planets that were in the beyond that now go back to the Stone Age from their perspective.
Yeah. That's really my last note is, so I spent time as a civilian working in Afghanistan. And so that colors a lot of how I read fiction like this, because that country has been through a lot of turmoil and a lot of war because of Western powers. I mean, that's not solely it, but that's a lot of it. And so reading through this book, I think about that a lot, that Vinji really doesn't make a value judgment on was this action a good action or not. And he really does, unlike a lot of other authors, say, they did this, I think he says, like, this wave, you know, went high and swept over trillions of people in the galaxy and, you know, killed millions, plunged, you know, these transcendent and beyond and transcendent sites into the slowness. This is a really high price to pay. And like Ravna and Fam have a really significant decision to make when they get to this world of, do we, like, we're starting to suspect what countermeasure is. Should we use this? And like I said, my experience, my time in Afghanistan really makes me think through a lot of those questions on, you know, we have an opportunity to do something, but are the negative things that are going to happen to someone else that probably aren't going to come and affect us, should they offset what we are going to do? My answer is generally, yeah, we really do need to consider the secondary effects and only plunge someone else into chaos if doing so really is going to help them as well as help me. But I do think that Vinji this is a post-Cold War novel. You know, he's writing this late 90s, early, or late 80s, early 90s. And it really is of that time. And he really is exploring some of the, you know, there's not two superpowers warring against each other. There's essentially nature coming and, you know, randomly attacking. What do you do with that? So
it's interesting how much that thought that you're talking about, making the decision, you know, for other people, ties into what we're covering on Take Me to Your Reader this month, which is Button Button by Richard Matheson. And so we're having that discussion tomorrow. So I'll be thinking about that.
Really, my final overall impression, like I said earlier, this really is one of my personal favorite books. And it is not a book for everyone. If you like singular character dramas, if you like really, really fleshed out, developed 3D characters, this probably isn't your book. But if you really like big ideas, thinking through the implications of those ideas in a fictional space, then this really is the kind of book that would be up your alley.
Yep, agreed. Well, Russ, I really want to thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Is there any contact info you want to give out? You on Twitter or any other social media where you invite people to find you?
You know, I'm on Twitter at Russ Newcomer. I don't really tweet a whole lot. I don't really participate on social media that much. But if someone wants to discuss the book, you know, sure, send me a message and I might see it in 2 to 3 weeks when I open up Twitter again.
Right. Yeah, it's social media can be really useful for talking about things you like, but there's so much more talking about what people don't like. And, you know, hey, what's the most overrated movie you've ever seen? I think I'm not going to reply to that. You know, I'd rather talk about what's your favorite movie. And this is something where, you know, there's a base instinct in you to just be like, oh, well, it's Interstellar or something, you know, try and have a hot take on something. And it can be good, but there's a lot of bad out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for doing this. And I'm sure I'll talk to you down the line.
Thanks, Seth.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Russ. I had a good time. Just kind of standard sign-off stuff here. I have mentioned a couple times that I am starting to run out of titles that are available to be claimed. So if you've been procrastinating, it's getting down to the last minute here. I just looked. I have 11 titles left that are not claimed. And that's the whole list. I'll have to pick up the 2021 winner as well at some point, but that, you know, so that makes 12. So that tells you that if you want to get on the podcast, you do need to send me a message. So go to hugospodcast.com and fill out the contact form there, or send me an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or hit me up on Twitter. Yeah, that's how you get in touch if you want to be on the podcast. If you want to support the podcast, you can make sure to leave a review wherever you listen to the podcast, tweet out the episodes, share them on social media with your friends, tell people about it verbally. That's great too. And if you would like to support the podcast financially, you can go to patreon.com/hugospodcast and sign up to support there. I also wanted to mention, I don't mention it often enough, I do have another podcast, Take Me to Your Reader. I think it's a really fun podcast talking about adapted science fiction. We're doing some fun titles lately, and I can see this from the stats that more people listen to The Hugo Show than Take Me to Your Reader. And I want to invite you, if you haven't already checked it out, then go ahead and do that. The website, for some reason, is pavementpodcast.com. Ask me sometime and I'll explain it. But if you would like to listen in there, I think you would enjoy it as well. I do that with my friend Colin and my friend James. And I think that'll about do it for this time. So thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.